your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Did you know that Jonas Salk tested his polio vaccine on himself and his family? Did you know that 6 years after the introduction of the Salk vaccine, polio, that devastating disease, had been eliminated, and yet his peers shunned him? He was effectively banished. Not effectively, he was banished from his own foundation, from the Salk Foundation that he founded. Did you know that if you read his books, which he wrote later in life, he sounded like he was part of the core KALW listenership of today? And this was a long time ago. He wrote about social responsibility. He wrote about environmentalism. He wrote about collaboration, not just competition. What life and career lessons can we learn from Jonas Salk's life? With me to address that is the author of Salk, and a Stanford professor of medicine, I might say. The name of the book is Salk, A Life, typically understated, just the way she would do it. It is the definitive biography of him. The New York Times called it, quote, science writing at its best. Charlotte Jacobs, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you.
So, when you were a child, polio was part of life, a scary part of life. To paint a picture of what that was like.
Well, when I was growing up, the kind of carefree days of summer were overshadowed by polio. The magazines, newspapers, the newsreels at the movie house all displayed pictures of children struggling with crutches or entombed in an iron lung. And what made it even more frightening is that no one could predict which town or which child would be the crippler's next victim. So when Jonas Salk, April of 1955, announced that he had his vaccine had been effective and polio now could be prevented, he became an overnight hero. He was the hero of my generation.
You can understand why. You use the word entombed. It's perfect. I remember as a little boy, there was one kid who was in an iron lung. What could be scarier than as a child walking down the street, seeing an open window, and there is this child whose head is sticking out in this, looks like a big, what would today look like an MRI machine, but you don't go in there for 5 minutes, you go in there for life, and a short life. Amazing. Anyway, he was not, what's amazing about him, he didn't develop the polio vaccine. He was a key person in the development of the polio vaccine. And then, of course, that overshadowed his other major accomplishments. He was the co-developer of the first flu vaccine. He started the Salk Institute. We'll talk about it a little bit more later. He worked on a treatment for multiple sclerosis. He, you know, in some ways, and for cancer, he was in some ways like a father of immunotherapy. We're now doing cancer immunotherapy. Well, is by the way, you're the doc, not me. Is it fair to say that he could be seen as a pioneer in immunotherapy for diseases like cancer or
more in multiple sclerosis than cancer? I would say.
Okay, what was really puzzling to me is this kid, I'll say he was a kid, he was born in Harlem. He was the son of a lace maker. He was bright, but he wasn't brilliant. He had poor verbal skills. He was shy. And throughout his life, he had many detractors, yet he accomplished so much. What career-related lessons can we learn from his life?
Well, as his biographer, that was, of course, one of the major questions that I was pursuing. And I think he had a lot of innate characteristics that helped him and propelled him along. And it started with his amazing idealism. He was a dreamer. His mother, when he was a child, told him that he was born with a caul. That's a thin membrane over the amniotic membrane over the face when they're born. Mm-hmm. And that is supposed to mean that someone is destined for greatness. And from the time he was a young child, he used to pray daily that he would do some noble deed someday to help mankind. In fact, his brothers used to kind of laugh at him and call him little Jesus. But he believed her. And he was so mission-driven through his entire life to help mankind.
You know, one of the things that shocked me when I read your book, and I really did read almost all of it, it's about a 500-page book, but I really read almost all of it, I was a little dispirited by the lack of idealism in most scientists. I would have thought that most scientists, through their life, are willing to endure long, horrible experiments, having to deal with experiment, because they're driven to help mankind, and yet there was a thread that many or most of them are driven as much by, I want to get the grant, I want to get another publication, etc. Have I inferred correctly about many of the scientists in the real world?
Well, I don't want to generalize about scientists in the real world, especially as a member of the faculty at Stanford. But in order, if you start out and you definitely want to find the answer to a question, that's what a scientist wants to do. They have a question and they want to be able to answer it. But, you know, you don't have a fairy godmother. You don't have a fairy godmother. You have to get grant money. Who's going to pay for your lab and et cetera? So people are constantly driven to get grant money in order to pay for their research. You can't be promoted and stay at a university if you don't publish.
You know what that brings to mind the thought? If I was starting again, I might be an independent researcher. I've been at universities, not as permanently as you, but the amount, even as a peripheral person, the amount of politics, the amount of bureaucracy, the amount of rules is enormous. Is it delusional to think that a person, not if you need a $10 million grant, but is it delusional to think that independent scholarship, being an independent researcher, is real, or is that just not realistic?
Well, it's not just the academic medical center. Whether if you're in a pharmaceutical company working as well, there are rules and regulations. But all of those come from the government, and they're protective, so that you can't just go out willy-nilly and start a trial on a patient.
No, not on a patient. But let's say I was interested in fundamental research on cancer, and I had a couple of hypotheses that could be done at relatively low cost, and I was simply doing it. And, you know, they criticized Jonas Salk for being almost like a kitchen scientist. He did a lot of his stuff, you know, on a shoestring. So let's say somebody who says, you know what, I'm just fantasizing here, and this I'm just talking about career stuff. Let's say I finish high school, and I say, so much of my time that I'm spending in that classroom feels not the optimal use of my time. So you know what? I am not going to go to college, but I'm going to be with laser focus. I'm going to read, study, call, visit, mentor people in this little niche of whatever, of oncology research. And then I'm going to come up with some hypothesis that's exciting that I can do and afford to do on a shoestring. And then I am assiduously careful, and then I submit the article. Am I going to be laughed out of things, or is independent scholarship a realistic option for the many listeners to the show who are not going to go and do this traditional laborious long route?
Well, that's an interesting question. First off, you can't really do much on a shoestring in terms of basic science research. That's part of the problem. It's a little, I hate to use the word naive, but I'm pretending like I'm that person you're talking about, to think that there is so much basic science that one has to learn first. If you don't know all the biochemical pathways or the pathways in a cancer cell, for example, how can you begin to hypothesize where you're going to try to block it? Now, that doesn't mean that great ideas shouldn't be pursued, but it's not quite as easy as you might make it.
Fair enough. Let's go back, though, to the attributes of Jonas Salk that may be relevant to us, that despite his being not that brilliant, being quite a bright guy, but no, there were smarter, better communicators, people who were less shy, what could we take away that may be malleable, that may be developable, that we might learn or be inspired by in terms of from Jonas Salk's life?
Well, he was intuitive. He was a very intuitive scientist. So when you say he may not have been the brightest scientist, he had a way of viewing things slightly differently. And he was willing to be what my husband calls a contrary thinker. He hated conflict. but he was willing to move forward and almost do an end run around it so that he could pursue some of his hypotheses. And he was a very diligent worker. So, I mean, this is an amazing thing to me, is that he had this idea of making a vaccine with a killed virus. Now, at that moment in time, most of the scientific community felt that it had to be a live virus that was weakened so that you were giving someone a little bit of an infection. So smallpox was the classic. He said, I don't believe that it has to be that way. I think you could kill a virus so that there's no danger and you could still have an immune response. And he pursued that. He made a polio vaccine in 3.5 months, whereas it would have taken years on the usual route people were taking.
Right. So just to clarify, what the theory of immunology is, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but it's that we can confer even lifetime immunity by giving a weakened form of a live virus or a dead virus. There's still stuff in there that creates what's called antigens, anti-generation somethings, which in the body therefore serve protectiveness against the actual serious disease.
Well, it's antibodies.
Antibodies, thank you.
They
not
serve
antigens.
As an antigen for antibodies.
Okay.
Right. But now the whole field has changed even since Salk, where portions of a virus, so you don't have a live virus, can now cause an immune response, such as in measles, for example. So
let's let our listeners know what you're listening to. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. This is not the biology hour, nor the medical hour. This is Work with Marty Nemco, and I am talking with Charlotte Jacobs. She is a professor of medicine at Stanford University and the author of the definitive biography of Jonas Salk, which I like to keep saying. The New York Times called it science writing at its best. The name of the book is, very understated, Salk Alive.
Jonas Salk Alive.
Jonas. Oh, it's not just Salk Alive. Thank you very much. You could be right. I'm wrong again. Okay. You spend a decade researching and writing this book, and years, I don't know how many, about a lesser known but also deeply flawed in a different way, medical researcher named Henry Kaplan. Now, you're a physician, as I said, professor of medicine. Have you, Charlotte Jacobs, changed professionally or personally from writing these biographies?
I think they... Both men showed me a different way to look at life. I'll use Henry Kaplan. Henry Kaplan designed the first linear accelerator, the one that's used to treat cancer today, and was responsible for the cure of many, many patients around the world. And he was a very multidimensional man who was loved and hated. But he had this great, amazing ability to connect with patients. So here he was, a great scientist. Mm. When he was in that room, there was no one in the world but that patient. Mm-hmm. And the way he related to his students. So he was a wonderful role model for me. Now, I happen to have known him personally, which helped a lot. I think with Jonas Salk, Jonas Salk is a wonderful example of a dreamer. You can dream dreams. You can make a difference in this life.
How do you deal with? I mean, if there was a motto under the Bay Area flag, it would be follow your dreams, do your path, follow your passion, do what you love, the money will follow. And yet, for every Jonas Salk, there are 10,000 people who follow their dreams and are waiting tables. There's no rule. I'm not asking for a rule. That's impossible. But what are your thoughts on titrating, if you will, the desire for follow the dream versus being, quote, realistic? Any thoughts on that at all?
Well, he was tenacious. I mean, that was one thing about Jonas Salk. He would never give up. And he was an idealist, but he was also a realist. He knew that he had to go to medical school and he had to have certain training, and he knew what the problems were. But once he decided to solve a problem, he reminded me of a dog holding on to a bone. He would not let go. He was also incredibly hardworking. Incredibly hardworking.
Give me an example. How hardworking was he?
He was almost never home. He was when he was testing the polio vaccine in secret, he almost lived at the Watson home where he gave all the injections himself and wanted to wait around and make sure that nothing happened. He was consumed with his work and with his obsession with polio.
Didn't he write that marriage and being a leading scientist are incompatible? Is that, didn't you say something like that in there?
I don't remember.
Anyway, actually, it doesn't matter. Okay. If I want to go to the well one more time. Let's say we want to extract one more work-life lesson from Jonas Salk's life. What would it be?
Well, there are two of them.
Okay, I'm a very generous host. You can tell us both.
Go for your passion.
You would do so then, okay. That's
what it is. Go for your passion. And the second is that one of the things I found admirable about him is he had enormous equanimity.
Mm.
The scientific community was brutal to him.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that
absolutely
later.
Absolutely brutal to him. And he had this ability to rise above it.
Wow.
He never raised his voice. He never criticized other people. He had a road that he was going to go down, and he was not going to get put off that road. And so he never fought back. He just continued on.
Well, one of the things we like to do to continue on here on KALW is we want to keep public radio strong. If, like me, you like no commercials, if you like and commercials are not just having to endure the commercials. You know what? When the show has commercials, there is some amount of beholding that the show producers or hosts have to the sponsors. Here, 70% of our money to keep the radio lights on come from you. Only 30% come from National Public Radio or whatever, but really, in the end, it comes from you. So twice a year, and this is the only time right now, now is the time, if you enjoy, get pleasure or learn or whatever from public radio, and in specific, work with Marty Nemko, because every dollar you do give to KALW is a dollar, a vote for work with Marty Nemko and public radio and KALW. So 1-800-525-9917 is the number to pledge or donate, whatever. And we like to I like to say thank you. And so there's two ways we can say thank you. For a $120 donation, you will get a free autographed copy of my book, Careers for Dummies. You know, those yellow and black dummies books. And if I can say so, it has only 5-star ratings. And it is a perfect book, to be honest. It's for people a year or two either side of college or graduate school graduation. It's a launch pad. It's a great book for a launch pad, choosing a career, getting the job, succeeding in the job, dealing with stress management, time management, all the rest of it. I'll give out the phone number, 1-800-525-9917, or you can go to the website, kalw.org. Are there people in the phone room? I don't know if there are. Should I just send them to the website, or are there people in the phone room? There are. Oh, excellent. Okay, 1-800-525-9917, or go to kalw.org. It really, how do I say this? It feels good to be a part of public radio. It feels you're changing hearts and minds, and that's a pretty darn good cause to give. And when you support a responsible public radio station like KALW, you are changing hearts and minds. You are educating, entertaining, and elevating. That's a pretty darn good use of your money. 1-800-525-9917 or kalw.org. And for the coup de grace, something I do as part of my, in addition, I do this show. I don't get paid to do this show. This is also part of my volunteer work, and I'm donating the books, but I'm also donating something else that I think you'll benefit from especially. It has been my privilege over the years that I've been doing this show to take donors out to brunch with my wife. Those of you who've listened to the show and you hear my wife, Barbara Nemko, on the show with me, we take people who are donors out to brunch at the Doyle Street Cafe, a lovely place in Emeryville. And it's going to be on June 30th, which happens to be my birthday, at 11:30. So for $150 a person or $275 for a couple, you can join us for brunch. And it is mostly, it is fun. But also, if you've got career questions, you can ask me up close and personal. So at it, whether it be at the $120 level for an autographed personalized copy, you can say who you want me to write the autograph to of Careers for Dummies, or you would like to come to brunch on June 30th with Barbara and me. And the great feeling of supporting public radio, 1-800-525-9917, or go to kalw.org. And now I cannot resist going back and asking Charlotte Jacobs, the author of Jonas Salk, A Life, more about him. He's in my mind, one of the more fascinating people and more nuanced, and the book really presents the nuance. He's not just the cartoon character hero that the newspapers would say. One reason for Salk's ostracism by his peers was that he was more of a solo operator than a team player. And that would even be more of a sin today, in which being an individualistic person is deemed downright cowboyish, John Wayne. And yet many people hate, being really honest today, a lot of people today hate working in teams. Any thoughts about that?
Well, just first to talk about Salk a moment, the money, there wasn't big money to pay for research at that moment in time. And the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, better known as the March of Dimes, collected hundreds of thousands of dollars and paid the researchers. And so Basil O'Connor, who was the head of that, had a committee on immunization that their charge was to help figure out a way to prevent polio. And the top scientists, the senior polio scientists, were on that committee. Jonas Salk was a little bit at the lower end of the pecking order. So they were going ahead with all their plans for a live virus vaccine that was going to take several years. Meanwhile, 1952 comes along and 57,000 Americans contract polio. Jonas Salk had this idea. He did not want to wait in line behind these senior scientists moving along at their schedule. So that's when he became this solo scientist, as you talk about. He knew what he wanted. Basil O'Connor actually gave him money, not telling the other people about it. He made his vaccine, and he tested it in secret. And wham, it's a home run. They were all not very happy about that. Now, how could he do that? Well, he was a visionary. And he was a big dreamer. And science needs those kinds of people, or every profession. I just will talk about medicine or science because I know them. And certainly we have moved away from what you call the bench to bedside solo person who has an idea in the lab, comes up with something, then takes it to the clinic or to the bedside and treats the patient, and which is essentially what he did, if you make it simplified. And so everything is big teams. And so when they are doing, when you look at a scientific paper now, often it has 20 authors. Mm-hmm, you can't even tell whose idea it was.
Right.
And that stifles the big thinker. And a lot of the clinical research now is done through pharmaceutical companies who have a single endpoint. And what happens to the visionary in that situation?
So what's a person, you know, some people listening to this show are feeling like, you know, yes, I feel like I would get squashed and reduced to the lowest common denominator if I have to deal with a 20-person committee and get everybody's approval and consensus. But that's the real world. Do you have any advice for today's Jonas? It doesn't have to be Jonas Salk. You could be a plumber, you know, but you're more of an iconoclast. You're more of a contrarian. You're more of an individualist. Could anybody like that survive at Stanford?
Oh, yes, I think so. They do. I mean, there are plenty of single scientists who are working in their laboratories and making major contributions. Once you begin down the road of applying it now to the clinic, to patients, that's when bigger teams come along. But the dreamer, the dreamer, the visionary has to be willing to take the risk that it will never pan out, or that they'll be a pariah, or
not get funding.
Yeah, not get funding. Not get to be, you're out of that plumbing job right. because you have a new way that you want to regulate the toilets or something. And so that's the thing. You have to be willing. Jonas would go with his passion. He was a visionary. He would go with his passion no matter the cost because he had a goal in mind. Mm. And I think that takes a very, very special and strong person in this day and age.
And also, you know, apart from whatever drive you might have, you use the word he did it in secret. Am I correct that that was in 1952? Today we have all kinds of layers of human resource subject approvals and whatever. So secret is a word that's not in the vocabulary of today's scientists. Is that a fair statement?
Right. But that came. It mostly came about in 1962. You remember the thalidomide tragedy.
Of course, yeah.
After that, everything, new drug development, has mm-hmm. to go through the FDA. That is for their protection. But there are lots of great new ideas that come up, but they have to. That is for the human's protection.
Of course, so. I just noting that Salk probably the vaccine. Let's pretend that in 1952, when Salk was doing his work, and O'Connor and Rivers and all the rest of them, that there were the protections of human subjects committees, etc. How much, if at all, would that have delayed the introduction?
Yeah, so it's interesting. At one point, I did a kind of a semi-analysis, and my husband is in the medical device world and helped me a little bit with it. And it's not just the human subjects. It's all of the governmental controls along the way and the money that is required and the hoops you have to go through. Mm-hmm. And we calculated it would take about 10 years and about $10 billion in order to accomplish what he wanted to do. That was kind of frightening because when you think of some new infection coming along, you don't want to wait that long. Now, obviously, things are on a little faster track right now, but it's enormous. So in a sense, the government's thrown out the baby with the bathwater, if you take that analogy.
Yeah, and $10 billion, you know, no drug company would invest
maybe a billion, but a lot.
You know, it would be very difficult for. I mean, we cringe at the horrible prices of drugs, and yet if I am a drug company and I'm merely trying to stay in business, and if you tell me you're going to have to spend somewhere between $1 and $10 billion and 10 years, hoping that this drug is going to work, it's going to make me want to be very gun shy and not try to develop anything other than some sure thing. Certainly not be a contrarian. Is that a fair assertion?
That is fair. Vaccines are not a big thing that drug companies like to develop precisely for that reason.
Well, you know, you talked about how hard he worked. And I seem to remember, not in your book, but reading something years ago, that he worked 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, something like that. And you said, like, he had no time for his marriage or whatever. If the term work-life balance had been common in Salk's time, what might he have actually thought about it, and what would he have said in public?
Yes. Well, I think it depends in which chapter of his life. Initially, the term work balance was not in his vocabulary, nor would it be. So he married this wonderful woman, social worker. They had 3 kids. There were tons of pictures of them reading together, flying a kite together. None of that ever happened.
Right, that was media stuff.
It was all media stuff. And the kids were sent off to boarding school when they hit their teenage years, and that ended in divorce. Mm-hmm. And he was never home, except to, as she said, kind of change his shirt. Then later in life, after the whole polio was over and he was in his 50s, he met and fell in love with François Gillot. Now, François was this beautiful French artist, younger than him.
Picasso's good mistress.
Yeah, so I was just going to say, she's an artist in her own right, I have to say that, and she's still alive. Mm-hmm. She did write a memoir called Life with Picasso, which was a bestseller, about being Picasso's mistress all those years. So this was, you know, somebody totally different. And he changed radically. He, instead of wearing a tie and a suit, he wore an ascot and a turtleneck. He grew out his sideburns. His teeth were capped. He did Rolfing. He did sailed the Greek Isles. This is when he started to write some of his philosophical books. And he was into yoga and all of that. And in fact, one of his sons who I interviewed said that his father was Frenchified. And people said he never looked so good. He never seemed so happy. As time went on, they had an agreement that she could work in Paris by herself and paint 6 months out of the year. And their kind of relationship became more intellectual almost than a loving connection. And with time, things just kind of drifted. And he reverted. When he was alone by himself in San Diego, he reverted to the old Jonas Salk. You see him again in a shirt, you know, and a tie to the side, and, you know, eating carry-out Chinese food and things like that. Right. So he never quite maintained a work-life balance. And to some people, work is their love. It is their love.
I'm that way, too. It's not, for what it's worth, I'll, you know, be disclosing, it's not that I love it. I love hanging out with my wife more. I love playing with my dog. I love hiking. I like watching Netflix with my arm on her, my hand on her thigh. But I feel a cosmic, I know that's a word he used later, a cosmic responsibility to use my gifts while I have them. And so when I have a choice in the matter, I will almost always choose the work, because I'm no Jonas Salk. But if I'm writing another article for Psychology Today or doing another radio show or preparing, instead of just reading a couple chapters of your book, I thought my listeners would be better served, they would benefit if I read the whole book. So it's not necessarily making you happy, but
well,
there's
it
an
can.
Argument.
I mean, work to me has always been joyous. It's been as, it's part of the balance, but it is a joyous thing. And so I don't like the word, I'm sorry, this is your show. I don't like the word work.
Well,
that has a bad connotation.
You know, we're different here. I can't describe work as joy. I find my work the right thing to do, rewarding. I'm reasonably good. I've chosen work that I'm not bad at, so I don't feel too frustrated. But joy, no. Joy is sitting on the sofa next to my wife, watching a movie.
So that was not joy for Salk. For Salk, joy was seeing fewer kids with polio. That was his joy.
You know what joy is for me? Really? Public radio. I really mean that. You
well,
know,
that,
it's a little bit of a segue, you know, a little artificial segue, but it's also true. You know, I come back to what I care. I hate commercials for both of those reasons. One is, who wants to hear 4 minutes of commercials to interrupt an interviewer or something, or even music, you know? And also, I don't like to think that, you know, some, you know, tobacco company or pharmaceutical company is, you know, dictating what's going to be on the air in some measure, or at least shading what's going to be on the air. And if you feel the same way about public radio and you want to support it, now, this moment really is the only time to do it. If you hate work with Marty Nemco, you can donate at any time during this pledge drive. But if you like work with Marty Nemco, each dollar you donate now is a vote for work with Marty Nemco. And believe it or not, it does matter. And even, you know, I've been on the air almost 30 years, but it does matter in terms of whether I stay on the air or not. So if you're so inclined, I invite you to support KALW. It will feel good. You'll be making a difference. The phone number, 1-800-525-9917. And because some people are not just motivated intrinsically by feeling good, so making a difference, changing the hearts and minds of people, liking the help that they got from career, but they want a reward. We do respond to rewards and punishments. So I got a couple of rewards for you. If you donate at the $120 level, I will autograph personally, and you can, you know, when you leave your name with the phone volunteer or on their website, you can say, I want this inscribed to Mary Jane, you know, and maybe even a one-liner about what maybe you'd like to tell Mary Jane she needs to do, like get off her butt or whatever. In any case, so $120 will get you that. The phone number, 1-800-525-9917. This is the membership drive for KALW Public Radio, 1-800-525-9917. Or if you'd rather not talk to our friendly, lovely volunteers, you can go to KALW.org. And the coup de grace is my wife, Barbara Nemco, appears once a month on the show with me. We do consider it a privilege to the show. So in addition to donating the books, donating our time, we don't get paid for doing this. We donate a brunch. We don't always do it, but we're doing it now. if you would like to have brunch with Barbara and me, and it's no cattle call, usually about 10 people, because I don't want it to be a cattle call. I want it to be personal. If you will support, I don't get a penny of it, but if KELW and Public Radio will get it, $150 for one person, $275 for a couple, you can come to brunch with us on June 30th, 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917, or go to KALW.org. And I want to keep these membership drive breaks short because I know you do too. And so let us go right back to my conversation with Charlotte Jacobs. She's the author of Jonas Salk, A Life More Nuanced and Complex Than What We Have Seen When We Read Just the Headlines. And we're talking mainly about how can it benefit you and your life. Now, a lot of people pursue being well-known, even fame, as though it's wonderful, but it often comes as a large price. Wasn't there somebody who told Salk when he got famous, that's the worst thing that ever happened? Who was that?
That was Edward R. Murrow, the day of the announcement. And he said, young man, a great misfortune has fallen upon you. And Jonas, who was a very sweet man, by the way, said, what? And he said, you've now got anonymity. You've lost your anonymity. Right. And that was a rude awakening to him.
Paint a picture of the costs he paid for his fame.
So that day of the announcement, he became, as I said, an international hero.
The announcement, by the way, that he and his team had cured polio, had come up with say it accurately.
No, I'm reacting because his team didn't get a lot of credit. It was Jonas Salk. Nobody else. No one asked. Well, who else worked in your lab?
Was that because he was so selfish, or was that because the media wanted a hero?
That's because they wanted a hero.
Okay,
but and he was focused on the outcome. He just didn't pay enough attention, I guess, along the way to them.
Okay.
But anyway, so he's on the front of every magazine and newspaper. If he walks down the street, people want to come up and shake his hand. If he goes into a restaurant, it's like a movie star walked in. Mm. And within the first month after that, he received 10,000 letters, gifts, telegrams, phone calls. He got a presidential citation. He got the French Legion of Honor.
But isn't that good?
All of that is wonderful. However, the one group whose adulation or whose thanks or acknowledgement that he wanted was the scientific community, and they essentially shunned him. And in fact, Basil O'Connor, the head of the March of Dimes, said, here's a man who prevents polio, and they act as if he has halitosis. He said in later life, fame fell upon me like an albatross around my neck. I wish it had never happened. So there's always a good and a bad side. I mean, he did acknowledge it led him, opened the doors for him. He met presidents. He befriended Beverly Sills. When he talked, people listened to him. But the group that he really wanted to acknowledge him didn't. He didn't get a Nobel Prize. He didn't even get in the National Academy of Sciences, which is kind of like, you know, the fraternity sorority, mostly fraternity, of excellent scientists.
It always struck me as two separate problems. The shunning of his peers was one thing, but the fame itself seemed to impose a price. You know, he had to be dressed up all the time. His kids had to be dressed up in suits, tuxedos when they went somewhere had to go to these stupid parties. He, because he was a responsible guy, he felt the need to answer for a long time. He answered every one of his letters.
That even before he became famous. That was one of the amazing things about Salk that you would never see in a scientist. And that is that he answered every letter. I mean, women writing to him about, I'm afraid that my child might get polio. What can I do to prevent it? He was, and people, you know, my big toe's purple. What can I do about it? He answered every single letter. They're all in his archives. And then when he had 10,000 letters, he couldn't keep up with it, which was really hard for him. In terms of his sons, it's very interesting. They hated the suits, but what they hated more is that they became, the expectations on them, because they had a famous father, were very difficult for them. So his oldest son was an introvert, and he'd get up, he said, at Little League to hit a ball, and everybody would stand up, saying, he's going to hit a home run.
Wow.
That's Jonas Salk's son.
Wow.
And it was a major burden on them. And his wife, who was also very much of an introvert, she couldn't bear, you know, she didn't want to be interviewed by Good Housekeeping, and she didn't want to be in the fashion sections of papers. And she just couldn't deal with that kind of life. And the other thing that happened, though, is he changed a bit. He was a very humble man, and he was still humble, but his sons even said that. There was a Jonas Salk before and after April 12th, 1955. And so I think he did change. He thought a little more highly of himself. He was a little more sure
who
of himself.
Who would not at that, yeah. that point, yeah. all that acclaim? Yeah. You know, what was very interesting is when you were talking about the kids and the expectations. I mean, Charlotte, you know, you're hot stuff yourself. You're a professor of medicine at Stanford. You were a beloved. You had very high clinical ratings. You've written two definitive biographies, which is unbelievable. Nobody, you know, remarkable. You have five sons. Did they feel pressure to emulate you, exceed you, or do they feel inferior? I don't want you to tell you the dirty laundry, but what you feel you can comfortably say?
Well, I don't think so. When I was with them, one of the things I do is I can compartmentalize easily. So when I was with my sons, when they were growing up, I was with them. Mm-hmm. It was all about them, mm-hmm. going to their games, playing with them, reading to them, doing things with them. It wasn't about me. So I kept that part of our life separate. In fact, if I can just tell a cute little story.
Of course,
That tells it all. One of my sons, Adam, had poison oak, and it looked like it was going toward his eye. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to take him to see the pediatrician. Mm-hmm. And I was having patients, and I had to kind of squeeze it in between. And so I was rushing. I picked him up from daycare and, you know, come on. So we were going into the pediatrician's toward his office. And all of a sudden he goes, wait a minute. And he stops and says, aren't you a doctor? Like it just kind of dawned on him. So I think I tried to protect them. And my husband and I both said to all the boys, go for your passion. That's the important thing in life. Decide what you want out of your life and go for it.
You know, you're having talking about you, the trying to be a good parent at the same time as you were doing all this other stuff. You juggle an unusual number of balls. And dear listeners, there's some parts of Charlotte Jacobs you don't know. She's a very serious actress and a playwright, and a producer of her own of a show called Your Type. What is it called?
Just My Type.
Just My Type, which is, you know, has a real chances. How in the world have you juggled all this?
Well, I have to start by saying that my grandmother always said to me, she was Scottish, "Pride cometh before the fall." So. Nice things you're saying. I never like to toot my own horn.
But they're true. I haven't exaggerated a bit.
Because, and I have a very supportive husband, which is a real help. I think very early on, and I didn't grow up with a silver spoon in my mouth, by the way. I grew up in Appalachia,
yeah.
actually, and I was a B-plus student in East Tennessee, so I wasn't actually the smartest kid in the class either. But I had a library card, and my father and mother took us to the library on the weekends. And so as a child, I began to be able to dream. And that's one of the things that worries me today about kids is they're not allowed to kind of dream. Mm. But very early on in life, I kind of developed this philosophy of when I'm sitting in a rocking chair on the front porch at the end of my life, I do not want to say I regret that. And And later on, I kind of translated into, you only go through life once, so give it all the gusto that you've got. Of course, I was very disappointed to realize that that was the Schlitz beer commercial I don't know where I had gotten
I remember that one, yeah.
But in terms of the audience, some of the things that I think helped me. One is I'm very, very aware of choices. I consciously always am making choices. Do I want to tend the garden or do I want to tend patients? Okay, I get much more joy out of being with a patient than I do seeing a plant grow. Okay, do I want to watch television or do I want to be on the stage trying to convey something to the audience or bring something to the audience? Do I want to cook or go shopping or do I want to write? I want to write. And so to the extent that I am able to, and that's not totally disruptive to my family, I have always tried to make choices.
I want you to make a brief choice. Mm-hmm. This is a public radio membership drive here at KELW. I'm going to keep this really short. If you like Work with Marty Nemko, and Barbara Nemko especially, if you like, we do switch-in-the-middle debates where we'll take a topic like universal basic income, and we will take one side, and then in the middle of the debate, we'll switch take the other side, if you like those debates. If you like the interviews I have with, you know, as I'm looking here at Charlotte Jacobs, I think back about my interview with Craig Venter. I was able to get, who is the first decoder of the human genome, and yet I've also interviewed everything from a sumo wrestler and what it's really like to be a sumo wrestler to be a house cleaner and a wait staff person, whatever they call them, that is, they can't call them waiters anymore, whatever the right word is. But if, and of course I do workovers. If you have enjoyed hearing me torture, help callers with their work problem, 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917. Two thank you gifts, $120, autographed copy of Work with Marty of Careers for Dummies, $150 a person, $275 a couple. Come to brunch on my birthday, June 30th, and we'll have a great time and I'll answer your career questions. 1-800-525-9917 or KALW.org. I want to turn back to Jonas Salk. Very interesting. You said to me off the air, you thought this would be boring. I don't think this is going to be boring. I think this is central. He got into, in his later years, something he called biophilosophy, which was ridiculed by the people at his own institute, the Salk Institute, which ended up actually getting him pushed out. But it may have been very prescient. Tell us about Jonas Salk and his bio-philosophy.
Well, he... there are two things. That you're kind of putting two different things together that I don't kind of quite see together.
Okay. So straighten me out. You're the expert, I'm not.
Okay. So in terms of the Salk Institute, first off, he was seeking refuge from his fame, which he wanted to step back and to be able to think. And he always felt that the two cultures of the humanities and science, there's a huge gulf between them, and they really should meet together, that science should be, that the humanities or the feeling for mankind should be embedded in the sciences. And so he got Basil O'Connor from the March of Dimes to give him all this money to build an institute where he would bring scientists and humanists, and they would work side by side.
For example, a famous one was Jacob Bronowski, the author of Ascent of Man, who was at the Rockefeller University, Rockefeller Institute at that point. And so he really was committed to getting big-time humanities
people. That and big-time scientists. But all the scientists that he got initially were people who were involved in anti-war movements or whatnot. So it was a wonderful, wonderful dream. And how did he get all these Nobel Prize laureates and top humanists? He gave them total academic freedom and lifetime funding, so they never had to work for grants. They could just do what he was able to do because the March of Dimes gave him money. He wanted them to have that freedom that he felt he had had when he was making the vaccine.
And how is that different from the biophilosophy? Isn't that the same, that intersection of the humanities?
Well, yeah, that is. But and he, by the way, if you've never been to the Salk Institute, it's very interesting. They all have their lab and a little office in their lab, and then they all have kind of a tower where he thought that they would think great thoughts. And he sat there and thought great thoughts and wrote three philosophy books. Man Unfolding was his very first one. And he was truly concerned about all the things that we're all concerned about even more today in terms of climate and, right, and things you mentioned. But his writing...
Really, social, you know, those of you who weren't here the whole show, social responsibility, climate, collaboration, not just competition, all the, what might be considered core values of the KALW listenership.
Yes. And if he had gone out and, with his fame, gone out and spoken and been a leader, he might have made an impact. Instead, he wanted to be a writer. And his writing is circuitous. People couldn't understand it. And then they made a mockery of him. In fact, Bronowski called him the prophet.
Right.
Disparaging.
Not literally a prophet, but a disparagingly.
Right. So he...
Like a soothsayer.
He was... he had this great idea. They all bought into it. But in the end, he was a pariah in his own home.
Yep. You know, you were talking about all these details that exist in that biography. I am struck. You and I have opposite personalities. You are so patient. 10 years, and you know, there's 300 pages of footnotes and notes afterwards, which I did not read. But the text itself is so, you know, even one of his colleagues will die. It's described in great detail. You talked about the cornflower blue shirts that he wore. You were extraordinarily painstaking. What, as again, the show's supposed to be about work. What is it that drives, what's really at Charlotte, that drives Charlotte Jacobs' desire to be as painstaking as to take a decade to write a truly the definitive biography of Jonas Salk?
No, first off, I wasn't writing it full time. I was still doing other things, do the research.
Let's go.
So biography is really supposed to be a simulation of a life, not an account of a life. And
wow.
I love this one statement
nice
that E.M. Forreston said. The king died and the queen died. That's an account. The king died and the queen died of grief. That's a story. Mm-hmm. And so as a biographer, you really need to get kind of the vital spark of that person. And you have to be real about that person. And you cannot make up anything. I mean, that's why there's so many footnotes, because you have to document it. And so... writing about Salk was like somebody came in and put a ton of clay on my desk and said, sculpt Salk. Mm. And okay, so I start sculpting him. And every time I learned something new, I changed the shape of his eyebrow or the size of his nose. And so that the more I discovered about him, I mean, I knew nothing, very little about him. It was a journey of discovery. And that would change how I depict him. I had to be as accurate as I could. I had to really simulate his life, and you don't do that overnight.
And yet you were a balance of science and humanities. You described all the procedures. You described all the things in scientific, well-documented details. And yet your book ends, I believe, with a poem. And that may be a great way to end this interview. This is when Salk was relentlessly attacked by the media and colleagues for his spirituality, or they made him into this super larger than life superhero, which made him end up being ostracized because he really wasn't that grandiose or attention getting. Someone sent him a poem by Rudyard Kipling that might be instructive for all of us. Would you read that to us?
Yes. So, Marty, when you mentioned this to me about reading it, I said, I'd love to, because this was one of my favorite poems growing up. It's one that I have returned to so many times. And when I found it among his letters that someone had sent to him, I was delighted. Mm-hmm. So it's If by Rudyard Kipling, who actually wrote it for his son. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you and make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies. Or being hated, don't give way to hating. And yet, don't look too good or talk too wise. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostors just the same, If you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken, and stoop and build them up with worn-out tools. If you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it at one turn of pitch and toss, and lose, and start again at your beginnings, and never breathe a word about your loss. If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone, and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on. If you can walk, talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it. And which is more, you'll be a man, my son.
And you are a woman, my friend. Charlotte Jacobs, thank you so much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco. The book is Jonas Salk, A Life, but that dramatically understates the profundity, subtlety, and entertaining value of this book. She's been a playwright, so she knows about storytelling. I commend Jonas Salk, A Life, to you with no reservations. And there is one thing I do want to end before we have just a couple minutes. So if you are a procrastinator, as so many of us are, and you like public radio, and you like supporting Work with Marty Nemco, this now is the time to do it. You give $120 to KEOW. I don't get a penny of it, but it's 120 votes for Work with Marty Nemco. And you get an autographed, personalized autographed copy of my book, Careers for Dummies. You give $150 a person or $275 a couple. You and the person of your choice will come to meet Barbara Nemco, my wife, at brunch. And we have a great time. You can ask career questions. I've done this periodically over the almost 30 years I've been doing the show, and I've had many people come back multiple times because it is a lot of fun. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Of course, or you can go to kalw.org as well if you'd rather do it online. You know, some people are motivated to give for the thank you gifts, but you know, I guess maybe the higher cosmic reason is public radio is worth supporting. If you feel that way, non-commercial, very often not standard radio that's long form. How many on commercial radio, you're not going to have an hour-long interview with Charlotte Jacob talking about Jonas Salk. But if you value that kind of programming, not just Work with Marty Nemco or Barbara Nemco, who's at KU once a month, but there's a lot of great shows on KLW, from national shows like Morning Edition or This American Life, or local shows like Your Call, or Out in the Bay, if that's still on the air, I don't remember. It's not, I'm sorry. But a number of shows that are you know, certainly popular with the listeners, music shows like Folk Music and Beyond, whatever it is. This is the time to call 1-800-525-9917. $120 gets my Careers for Dummies autograph for you. $150 a person, $275 a couple. Come to brunch on my birthday, June 30th. We'll have a great time. 1-800-525-9917 or go to kalw.org. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for a word. No, you can't. But you can hear my wife, Barbara Nemco, and I. We're going to talk about encore careers and other career issues, like career for older people, like from avoiding being deadwood to landing a job in the second half of your life. Until next Thursday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't. We'll be right back.